The Morse code goes transcontinental in 5, 4, 3, 2. From the studios of the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Larry McGlore, KB9DIP, with this Rain Report Hamcast. As we learned in the first excerpt of this conversation Rain's Hap Holly, KC9RP, had with historian author Lewis Coe, W9CNY, SK, Morse code made a name for itself back in the 1850s on the American frontier.
It ran as far west as Omaha in the fairly early days. Eventually, that was the transcontinental line. It went through Omaha and then down through Laramie, ended up at Salt Lake City, and then from Salt Lake City, it went west to Nevada and then on to San Francisco. The miraculous thing about it was that it was all built in about a year's time. Congress appropriated the money to build it because the Civil War was imminent and it was considered very important to have this transcontinental communications. Bear in mind that California was almost a foreign country at that time. There was no transcontinental railroad until 8 years later, and they wanted to make sure that the country was united in this war effort, and that was one of the ways that they could do it, because otherwise it was such slow communication with California and the other western states that there was danger that if the Confederates might invade that territory and seize it or something. The communication was really very important at that time. The point is that these western states were pretty well isolated from the rest of the country. Anything west of the Mississippi was virtually foreign territory as far as the eastern block of states was concerned. So it sort of brought the whole thing together and enabled them to support the war effort and was considered a pretty important thing at the time. It was a miracle of line building because all the poles and everything had to be drawn by horses and all the holes were dug by hand. But it was a fairly simple line to build because it was just one single conductor on the poles. So they could build a lot of line. They built as many as 16 miles of line in one day. One time when they had to get someplace where they could get water, they had trouble with the Indians and you name it. Later, the line was pretty much rerouted to follow the Transcontinental Railroad, which ran a little bit different, but about the same general route. The original route more or less followed the Pony Express Trail, so it was a feat of construction when you consider the time of history that it was done, because they had nothing but horses and mules. Must have been a pretty hardy bunch that did that. They had to be armed to the teeth to defend against Indian attacks. They didn't know what they were going to run into. One of the first problems they had was the herds of buffalo. These buffalo had grown up on the plains, and most of them had never even seen a tree. When they saw all these telegraph poles, well, they discovered they were perfect to rub against. So they'd rub against these things and knock the poles down. And the poles were probably about 30-foot poles, and they would have to dig the holes 4 or 5 feet deep, and they did this just with hand shovels, but a good man with a long-handled spade or shovel can dig a hole in a very incredibly short time. It seemed like a monumental task, but they got used to it, and then they just manhandled the poles into the holes and tapped the dirt around them, and somebody shimmed up the pole and put up the wire, but it was a fairly simple job because it was just the one wire with a bracket insulator on the pole. But later when they built the transcontinental telephone line, it was a little more complex and they had hole digging machines then. And they also had a crossarm on the pole and had 4 wires to string against one. But it was still a big job and it was done at a time when nobody thought it could be done, really. They had these long pike poles, about 10 or 15 foot poles with a spike on the end, and they would start the pole up with that, and once they got it about a 30 degree angle, then a bunch of guys would just grab the pike poles and just walk it right in real fast. I would imagine they weighed 200 or 300 pounds at least. Once you got the butt end in the hole, then you could just walk it up there and put it in pretty easy.
What did they use to climb the poles in those days?
Well, linemen, from the very first, they had what they called hooks or climbing irons, and they still use them today. It's a strap, a thing that straps onto your leg, made out of steel, and it has a a right angle bend for your foot to fit into, and then on the inside, a spur or spike sticks out at the right angle to jab into the pole. Those guys got so they were very good with those things, they just scramble up those poles like squirrels, and of course they had the safety belts that they used after they got up the top of the pole. I know I've tried this, and it's not easy, but it takes a lot of strength to climb a pole because you got to have your body out from the pole. If you get your body too close to the pole, that's bad news because the spikes don't dig in then. So you had to have strength enough for your hands and arms to grab that pole. Then when you got to the top, you had to unsnap your safety belt and throw it around the pole and catch it and snap it into the other side of your belt, and then you could lean back in comparative comfort and do what you had to do on top. It took a lot of strength in the hands and the arms to grab one because you couldn't get all the way around it. You had to just grab it by the sides.
How big around were these poles?
Well, they were anywhere from 12 inches diameter to maybe 15 or 16 inches diameter. Of course, they got smaller at the top, but on the ground level, they were sometimes a fairly good size. But they didn't have creosote in those days. The poles were just natural wood, and so they didn't last forever. But creosote poles came in later, and the linemen called them blackjacks, and they were mean to climb, especially on a hot day because that creosote boiled out and you get creosote all over your hands. But the original poles were just plain trees that they chopped out of the woods.
You're in the middle of our second and final excerpt from a conversation Raines Hap Holly, KC9RP, had with Crown Point, Indiana author and historian Lewis Coe, W9CNY. We'll continue our brief journey into the history of CW after I remind you that this hamcast updates Saturdays on therainreport.com. It's heard Saturday evenings following the amateur radio newsline at 9 p.m. Central Time on WTWW 5085 kHz shortwave from Lebanon, Tennessee. We'll be right back. This is The Rain Report.
You're listening to The Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
What impact did telegraphy have during the Civil War?
There was a pretty well-developed telegraph network along the railroads that existed at that time. Then they organized the Military Telegraph Corps to provide communications for the Army, headed up by Andrew Carnegie, who came from the Pennsylvania Railroad, where he was the chief telegrapher. They developed a very elaborate system. They had what they called battery wagons that contained about 100 cells of battery and a place for an operator and instruments and so on. And these battery wagons, of course, were horse-drawn, but they could keep up with the columns of that day because the columns were marching on foot, so the battery wagons could keep up. They just strung line as they went along. They had rubber-covered wire that they could lay on the ground if they had to. By the time the troops came to a stopping place at night, for example, why the battery wagons hooked up the wire and could communicate right direct with Washington or any place they wanted to communicate with. So it was a very important thing for the Union Army. In the Confederate Army, they didn't do this so much because they were operating in their home territory and they used the existing lines along the railroads for their communication needs. But the Union Army developed this mobile telegraph system to a very high degree, and it played a very important part in dispatching troops and getting supplies and so on.
What was the beginning of the end for Morse code and viable communications?
Well, when I started as a Morse operator in 1929-30, why manual telegraphy, the dot and dash code, was still the main means of communication in the smaller offices, although the larger ones, since World War I, they had used printing telegraphs and so on the main lines. But in the countryside, it was still basically a manual system. But about 1930, why they started introducing these so-called tape printers, which printed the message on a half-inch wide paper tape, and then this was glued onto a message blank and delivered to the addressee. And so So that was the beginning of the end, and railroads kept using the manual Morse telegraphy until, almost 1950. Many railroads kept using it as long as they had any operators left that knew how to do it. But it was just gradually phased out in the period from 1930 to 1950. But at one time, you couldn't hardly walk down the main street of any size town, but you didn't hear a Morse telegraph working somewhere. And, of course, in a railroad depot, you always heard it. And it was just one of the background sounds that everybody heard. And, of course, those of us that were operators could actually read it. The telephone, even as recently as 1930, wasn't too satisfactory. I know in my town why most people relied on the telegraph for communication, because telephones were limited. There was a limited number of lines available. You would often have to wait for a line to make a call from, say, Galva to Chicago, which was only 140 miles away, and the quality was not there. They didn't have electronic amplifiers and repeaters on the telephones as they do now, and the telegraph was the important thing until about 1930. Why, it usually meant that it was an operator sending and receiving Morse code that did the job.
Lou, anytime you watch some of the old Western movies, inevitably, along the stagecoach line, there was a telegraph operator. How realistic was the portrayal of that person?
Unfortunately, in most cases, it isn't too realistic, but in the movie Western Union, they apparently had regular operators, and they sent real Morse code messages, which any operator could read. It was very realistic, but a lot of times they just have somebody sending a jumble of stuff that doesn't mean anything. And of course, any of us old operators that watch these movies can tell right away if it's the real thing. But in that one movie particularly, when it said the Indians are attacking the head of the line, why, that's what the Morse instrument was saying. So it was a nice touch of realism. And when you stop to think of the amount of money they spend for movies, any old operator would operate for a few bucks, you know, and lend a realistic sound to it, but they never done that too much.
That concludes our brief look at the evolution of the Morse code with Crown Point, Indiana author and historian Lewis Coe, W9CNY, Silent Key. While the Federal Communications Commission dropped code from the entry-level amateur radio license exam in the early 1990s, American history will forever be changed by those dits and das. Incidentally, in 1993, Lewis published a book entitled The Telegraph, A History of Morse's Invention and His Predecessors in the United States. It was published by McFarland & Company, with a few copies still available on Amazon.com. The Rain Report is copyright 1990-2018 Rain. All rights are reserved. This weekly hamcast updates Saturdays on therainreport.com and Saturday nights on shortwave juggernaut WTWW from Lebanon, Tennessee on 5085 kHz. Now I'm Larry McGlore, KB9DIP, bidding you a very 73 from the Radio Amateur Information Network. Keep on hamming!